session number 13114, Reel 3.
That's right. We'd flown the aeroplane on test. It was all right. And then they'd done this modification. And Mickey Benson said, "No, I'll come up with you, and just to make sure that the thing is all right before it goes to the squadron." And it shows in a way how you can't win. When we took off, luckily I had a chap called John Penny, who was another of the test pilots beside me. He got about three quarters down the runway. I said, "God almighty, John, we've lost an engine." And he looked at the dials and said, "No, you haven't. Continue." So I said, "Well, you have to help me push." So we were both pushing. I said, "We've lost a donkey." He said, "No, you haven't." He said, "Look at the gauges." And the gauges were all right. Well, I had to pull one engine back. And old Mickey Benson was in the back there. He said, "What's the trouble, man?" We said, "Well, it feels as though we got an engine failure, but we can only just about hold it." A yawn. He said, "Oh, but don't do anything." He said, "Wait till I get my parachute on. Wait till I get my parachute on. It's that bloody fin again." So we said, "Ah, steady." I said, "If we get to 1,000 feet, we might consider burning out." Anyway, we throttled it back, and it was controllable, just. So anyway, luckily there were airfields all the way down the zone, so having taken off towards the west, we were making an involuntary turn to a port because of the asymmetric power. It was, I can't remember the next one, Shandor. It was an airfield down the way from us. And I said, "Well, look, John, if we are careful and throttle the engine back, I reckon we can peg it down on that runway." So he said, "Yeah, let's have a go." So anyway, we did just that, and we managed to get it down on the Shenandoah, or whatever the place was called, only about 5 or 6 miles away. So anyway, terrific scene. We stopped at the end of the runway, and sweat pouring off as we climbed out, expecting to see the fin half hanging off. Perfect aura. Nothing wrong with it at all. Couldn't believe it. And we looked at each other in amazement, and we said, "We must have lost an engine." Although the gauges showed it, we couldn't make it out. And then old Glenn Marlin chap spotted, he said, "Have a look at your trim tab." And what had happened was, I've never done it since. In those days, one used to work the trimmers round through the full range every time before you flew. You know, four round one way, four round the other. And all that had happened, this is why we couldn't trim it out, because we tried, obviously, to trim out the force. It didn't work. Why we thought the fin had gone. And all that had happened was that the clever spin had dropped out once we wound on full tap. So we got full rudder bias on.
Even though the control had been wound back to a central position.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. My God, didn't half give us a fright there. In fact, that Marauder, I didn't do very much. I must have only done about 20 or 30 hours or something, but we had several hilarious escapes with it. Shortly afterwards, I think that can't have been the same aeroplane, must have been the next one. I very stupidly did the feathering check without putting the RPM up on the other engine. And the other engine was at a very low RPM indeed. We'd been cruising somewhere, and I said, "Oh, let's do the feathering check now." And when it came to unfeather the one we stopped, reverse current relays shorted out and ditched the electrics. Very couldn't unfeather it. Again, we couldn't keep it in the air on one with a very low RPM we had, and again we burst on somebody else's airfield. to the fury of the station commander, downwind across his main runway into some ground amongst some tents at the far end.
Were there a lot of marauder losses on operations?
No, I think they were pretty good on operations. In the Middle East, I don't know about Europe. It was a very sophisticated aeroplane for a start.
Little incidents happened to you when you were testing it, but your ordinary PO Prune didn't seem to be bothered by it.
Well, of course, you tend to get trouble if you muck around with aeroplanes, don't you? The worst flight I ever had in an aeroplane was in a Vulcan doing tests, which nothing would have gone wrong had we not been fooling around doing the test. I think on MU, that's what you were there for, really.
So what happened after the MU?
MU, I managed to get back on a night bow fighter squadron, back up in the desert. And I was with that until not very long. Until the end of July at 43, when I went sick with tummy trouble and was shipped home, and ended up doing accident investigation at 9 Group headquarters in Preston. Until I got my flying category back again. Although that must have been quite soon, because I see I was flying the 9 Group Comm Squadron aeroplanes around the various accident airfields.
What about those accidents? Were you looking at?
They were terrible. That really was awful. Funny enough, we were two flight lieutenants and a squadron leader. And the squadron leader did the office work, and we two went out round these 9 Group operational training units. And we only investigated fires in the air or fatal accidents or some very obscure one. So it shows what a terrible accident rate there was. There was enough accidents to keep the two of us going night and day. Just investigating fatal accidents. Horrifying.
Was there any pattern?
Oh, no, because there were different OTUs. There was bow fighter OTUs, night fighter OTUs up at Charter Hall. There was Spitfire OTU at Grangemouth. There were quite a few. There must have been about 10 stations. A lot of training going on then.
The bow fighters tended to be rather tricky.
Yes.
If they lost an engine on
takeoff. Well, that's right. Charter Hall had some very bad accidents because they had the Merlin engine. Bow fighters, which were bad news if you lost an engine. You really had a big problem keeping it up. Anyway, it was not an easy aeroplane in some ways on one engine. So the pattern really on the bow fighter accidents was on the Merlin engine bows were engine failures, and on the other accidents were mostly instrument flying problems. In fact, that was really the cause of practically 50% of the accidents, I would say, was instrument flying problems, you see. All these chaps have got very, very limited experience. And they found themselves on instruments at night sometimes or in bumpy cloud, and they lost it. It was a terribly sad occupation, it really was. Not nice. However, it was interesting. Particularly as some of the more difficult ones we could go with the accident investigation branch belonging to the ministry, the civil servant chaps. Some of those are brilliant, actually. They're interesting. On the sort of technical side. I remember trailing across some, I think it was in the Severn Estuary, with a chap who eventually became head of the AIB, a chap called Newton. This bear had gone in after witnesses declared that they'd seen the thing on fire in the air. Well, it went into the ground, of course, and immediately exploded. And normally you didn't believe witnesses who said the thing was on fire in the air, because two commonest things you got out of a witness was, oh, yes, I could hear the pilot shouting, look out, I'm going to crash. Or, yes, I saw it fly over the top of the house, flames belching from it. But I remember that Newton said, no, I think this one really was a fire. And we spent 2 days trailing around, and he found little drops of molten metal in the field, going for about 2 miles. Amazing piece of careful work. Anyway, so that went off then. What happened then? Oh, Lord. Then, sorry, I keep going to, my memories get so bad. Oh, yes, then I find myself at a, trying to get back on ops, that's right, and I find myself on a, what was it called, GSU, Group Support Unit. Now, these are units holding aeroplanes and making them operational ready with armament and everything else to escort to the squadrons during the invasion. So I am at, first of all, at Aston Down and then at Thruxton, testing Spitfires, Typhoons and Mustangs, I see. Until Spitfires, Mustangs, until God. Oh, yes, here we go. Pause. Yes, I'm these aeroplanes at this group support unit, 84 group support unit at Thruxton, until the end of September 44. And I find myself maddeningly promoted to squadron leader and sent out to Normandy to an airfield on the beachhead, B6, to organize airlifts. Not very much to my liking.
These are using Dakotas, presumably, are they?
Yes, well, I was purely a staff job. So, but although, that's right. Yes, it was a staff job at this B6 strip. And I get myself, I see a Spitfire 9, PL-191, which has been abandoned and has no instrument panel. But not deterred, because I've done so much Spitfire flying at the GSU. I use it as a an airplane to get about, and I fly to Brussels, and to Ghent, and to Leo Vonderville.
With no instruments.
With no instrument panel. That's right.
How do you check your airspeed then?
Oh, I'd flown enough. Enough in the Spitfire not to need to look at the airspeed. I could tell by the feel of it what the speed was. Oh, that's no problem, really, flying without an airspeed.
Compass?
A compass, yes, it had a compass. Oh, yes.
And what were these trips to Brussels and so on? I mean,
I can't remember. I just got them, I suppose. They were just sort of jolly trips, you know, get away from the thing. But anyway, I wasn't there very long, because they then decide. That's right. So I'm only there from October, but November then sees me posted to transport command on the basis that somebody has discovered that I'd flown about 30 hours in Liberators years ago in the Middle East. So they think I'm the chap for transport command, and I dispatched to Nut's Corner in Northern Ireland to do what they call a heavy conversion course. Which is quite interesting, actually, because we had to do Astro Nav, and I found it rather interesting, the navigation side. We were taught a lot of navigation. But
is this for transatlantic flying?
No, this was heavy conversion. And of course, one of the idiot things was, I see, in order to get to these Liberators again, you had to do five Stirlings. I mean, because a lot of people, of course, it was the first four-engine aeroplane. So although I flew in a Liberator, because I did the Stirling thing, which again was enormous fun, really. Ridiculous aeroplane.
Tell me more about it.
Oh, absolutely ludicrous aeroplane. Well, you know, it's a huge thing on stalks. And it was wildly basic, really, inside. The elevator trim was up in the roof. But on the ones they had at Nut's Corner, anyway, there was no cockpit lighting for it. So you see people before takeoff, the end of the runway, a sort of flicker of flame. And you're perhaps striking matches to see whether your elevator trim was weird. And the appallingly difficult thing to taxi, because it had differential brakes, worked off a handbrake lever to the left of the throttles. Well, you can imagine what this is like. Particularly with a small chap like I am, you've got to get the engineer, because there was no co-pilots in those days, the engineer had to hurl the other stick. So you had to put your left hand across on the handbrake and your right hand on the two outboard throttles, and get your feet on the rudder bars. Desperate thing for a small chap. Anyway.
Weren't they terribly underpowered as well?
They didn't fly very high operationally. That was a problem. They were very nice to handle.
They weren't heavy on the controls?
No, they were very nice. It was a very nice aeroplane. Very easy aeroplane, too. Except for the ground handling. You had to be careful to keep it straight on takeoff and landing. So anyway, I didn't need very much Liberator after that, because I'd already flown them. And eventually dispatched to a Canadian squadron at Holmesley South, down the New Forest, which are, I don't remember what they were doing, they were obviously a transport squadron. But I don't think they liked having the English put amongst them, because we never actually got operational with them. I don't think. No, we never did. And we were then broken up. That's right. Then they broke the crew up for some reason. I can't remember why this was, but in 1945 they decided, oh, they were short of Dakota pilots. So, March 45 saw me at Crosby and Eden doing a Dakota OTU. That was all right.
Doing a what?
Dakota. Mm-hmm. Dakota OTU. So we did the Dakota OTU. Mm-hmm. Then I always consider it was our fortunate episode when we celebrated VE Day 2 days too early, because a rather rigid station commander wouldn't concede that the war was over. So we really went to town. We had a really eerie scene in the mess. But anyway, some of us were then, to our dismay, found ourselves posted to India. So the next thing that happened was that I was found myself at Dum Dum, outside Calcutta.
You flew there, did you?
I was flown out by transport command crew. They flew us out. We didn't take the aeroplane out. was a regular service.
What was this, on a York or a...
Dakota. Stack. We flew out in Dakota to Dum Dum. And I joined 56, was it, or 52 Squadron? 52 Squadron, as a flight commander. And that I found extremely interesting. It was in the height of the monsoon. I'd never seen weather like it in my life before. It was a big squadron, and we did all kinds of things. We supplied the troops down in the Arakan, Burma. We had a trip a day over to Kunming in China, and we had a sort of service to Ceylon and Bombay and Delhi. You know, there's plenty of variety. But flying down that Arakan coast in the monsoon, absolutely unbelievable. It really was. And you could, of course, you had to stay below it always. And you to go, say, from Cox's Bazar down to Akiab or Ramri Island, you were right on the sea, looking out of the left-hand window, following the coast. You know, and it rained, they say.
And the turbulence pretty bad, I imagine.
Not a real bullet. But what was very, very spooky and very, very scary was doing that Kunming trip. Because you were forced up to, I forget now, I think 17,000 feet was our safety height at one point. Only the crews had oxygen. So anybody in the cabin just put up with the anoxia. And of course there was no radar. We had a thing called Loran, which was supposed to be to navigate with. Great when it was fine weather and you're not in cloud, but as soon as you're in cloud, the returns were so bad it wasn't very handy. But the other, I mean, ours was a minuscule contribution compared to the Americans who were flying, I don't know how many airplanes, 200 a day over from Barrackpore and places around Calcutta. But the whole thing was, of course, American controlled. And it was controlled on HF radio. And the HF radio was a nightmare because the range was so great that you could hear everybody in the hemisphere. So we sent the radio operators, did 8 trips with the Americans before they were allowed to go by themselves just for the radio problem. And it really was hairy. And also, of course, this business of blundering around in the cloud without radar, not knowing whether you're going to fly into one of these QNMs. Because there are an awful lot of high stratas over the Himalayas. So you'll be boring along in cloud, and you wouldn't know there was one of these damn CBs stuffed in them ahead of you. Could be very, very rough. Anyway, it was good fun. Interesting. What do we do? I did an interesting little trip to Shanghai at some stage. Why was that? I pitched the I fetched the High Commissioner, whoever he was, from Chongqing, and we flew down to Shanghai just after the Japs packed in. And that was quite interesting. Can't find it here. But all the Japanese were still walking around in Shanghai with their rifles and everything. It was very astonishing. We spent about three days there, I think. Anyway.
There were no problems. I mean, peace had been signed by then.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Oh, yes. Then what happened? Oh, then I... Oh, yes, then by this time, yes, in December, signals kept coming from Air Ministry saying Martin to report to the test pilot school at ETPS at Cranfield. Well, having so much enjoyed this Dakota flying in India, I said I don't want to get this test pilot's course at all, so we ignored the first two. Until finally a very peremptory signal arrived saying you must report for this course. And there was a chap with a broken down York at Dum Dum. And I said, well, can I come with you as co-pilot on your York back to UK? A chap called Chalmers. He said, yes, okay. So I signed on as a co-pilot on this York. And we flew it back to Lynham.